A Taste of Ireland with Ireland's Blue Book. A romantic collection of Irish country house hotels, manor houses, castles and restaurants. Ireland'sBlueBook.com.
On Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
Hi, I'm Ed Finn and you're very welcome to A Taste of Ireland. I'm delighted to be joined this evening by Paul Flynn, chef and owner of the Tannery Restaurant in Dungarvan. Paul, lovely to see you.
Hi Ed, how are you?
I'm very good. How are you keeping?
Good, good. This is a swift journey up to Dublin and back again. That's all we get these days.
Paul, just to bring it back, I suppose, to your early career, you're from Waterford yourself.
Yeah.
What was it like growing up in Waterford? Where did your love of food come from?
Well, the love of food, I think music started first, really, before the food, because there wasn't that much brilliant food inside the house. My mother had 8 children, me being the last of them, one wilder than the other. And it was really, as it was with many houses in the 60s, just a question of getting food on the table. And how she did it, I don't know, in terms of cooking 2 or 3 meals a day for the gang. But it was the same in many houses, I think. You know, I was we lived over a chemist in Dungarvan, right in the middle of the square. And that was pretty, it was great. I mean, we used to just, I suppose, the older brothers, their breakfast consisted of drinking out of the milk bottle on the way. It was on the steps. On the way to school, they just slug out of the milk bottle and then they'd be roaring afterwards. I told you not to drink the milk, and that was their breakfast, but sure, they didn't mind. But food really came, you know, we used to get fed, of course. Simple things, bacon and cabbage and roast chicken and stuff like that. But really, I think there was a eureka moment where I was in the Scouts and we went to France, and it was very exotic at the time. And I, amongst all the kids, I alone enjoyed the chicken and tarragon cream sauce with pilaf rice, and I was going, what the hell is this stuff? I really like this. Can I have more? Something kind of actually dawned on me then, and I used to cook at home really at all, and then I started doing just simple things like fries and having the mates round after the disco, which was never really appreciated, as you can imagine. And but then what it was, after my dramatically successful Leaving Cert, I got a job on a scheme in a local restaurant. That's how it happened. But as soon as I went in the door, there was a lovely man who was the head chef, and I felt at home. I liked the warmth because I didn't like being outside. I was never good at sports or anything like that. I was one of the guys who just was in the anorak walking around the pitch, never picked on a team. And but I love the coziness of it. I love the pace of it, which is a really important thing, because you know, a kitchen is a very pressurized place when we get into what we call service, and you have to be able for it. You have to be able for it. Come on, you know, let's go now, lads. We have to build. It's like building up steam, and then you release the steam, and then it's kind of, you know, but before you know it, it's 10 o'clock or 10:30 at night, and that was my life. At 17, I went into that kitchen, and when I was 18, I decided to be a chef, and I went to London.
I read that you started with Nicola
Dennis. I suppose I had a couple of dodgy jobs writing letters in hotels, very mediocre hotels in London. But I made up my mind, if I was going to go to London and be a chef, I wanted to be a good one. I wasn't just going to go over there and just waste my time. So I was writing all these letters based on the Michelin Guide to really fantastic restaurants. And I ended up getting a job after a while in a 2-star Michelin in Battersea at the time, a small family-owned place. And there I was 19, and I remained working for Nico. Working my way up in various different restaurants for 9.5 years, really. But by the time I was 23, I was his head chef.
Wow, for a young Irish guy from Waterford at 23, that was a pretty good achievement at that stage.
No, it was pretty spectacular. Not that I'm supremely talented, I'm not, and I really mean that. I was a grafter, and I threw myself into it. And it really was a case of just being in the right place at the right time. But it was a very high-profile job for such a young person, and I ended up at his head chef for 5 years until the pull of home came. It was always there, really. You know, I loved London. I had a really great time because I was earning decent money, and you know, we used to be up in Camden Palace and go see loads of concerts and up to the Mean Fiddler. And you know, I lived in Knightsbridge for a time. You know, we didn't slum it. The first couple of years were a bit dodgy while you're getting up on the ladder. and there was a lot of missing home. But really, I made the most of London, had great friends, great memories, and still have great friends over there.
In those days, Paul, London was really the place to go. I mean, even Dublin, the restaurant scene would have been pretty tame, wouldn't it? Or pretty small.
Right. Yeah, you're right. I mean, there used to be one or two good places, and they were very fancy. I remember that. They were out of, not my league, but I couldn't imagine eating there. But somehow, you know, you just went into, I went into London, what you get is confidence. And I used to eat in a lot of restaurants in my spare time, because you learn from eating in restaurants as well. But the whole driving thing was, I wanted to be good. And to be good, good restaurants are your university. If you learn in a mediocre place that doesn't really give a crap, that's how you're going to be. So you have to aspire, and good restaurants and learning in them is like going to Trinity College or Cambridge or Oxford or something like that, or UCD. You have to aim high to be high.
Very interesting, Paul. And you returned then, as you were saying, in 1993. Then, of course, you were here for a few years, 4 years. And then, of course, in 97, you opened the famous, well-known tannery.
Yeah, I mean, I worked in a place called the La Stampa in Dawson Street, which is very, I mean, it was really different to what I left behind in London. I was headhunted for the job, and I didn't know Dublin at all. I knew London really well, but not Dublin. I'd been there maybe twice or three times, and I know that sounds a bit mad, but I was either in Dungarvan, and then I went to London, and then I was working, and then I spent my time at home, you know, on my holidays. But really, Dublin didn't enter the picture. So I was very, not naive, but just new to Dublin, didn't know it. But I came and I ran La Stampa for four. It was really well known at the time. Celebrities were in every single night. Not that we saw them, but we were cooking for them, certainly. But then I got the pull of living in the country. I think that's what it was. And I just happened to end up at home with my wife, Maura. We got married when we were in Dublin. And and she's from just out the road.
I remember when La Stampa, is very interesting. That brings me back, actually. I think it was the Blackham and Marr. John Marr was the architect who designed that. And I remember going in there and being wowed by the massive big flower. You know, it was a really, it was really the place to be in Dublin at the time. I remember it was beautiful.
Yeah, it totally was. It felt very Parisian. There was a very much a brasserie feel to it. And that was the first place that I ever worked that taught me that being in a restaurant could be a bit showbiz. It was about the entertainment, it was about the evening, it wasn't about the food that's on the plate, it wasn't about paying homage to the chef, which I never really believed in anyway. Food is very important as part of your night out, but it's not the whole thing.
Brilliant. And you came back, Paul, with this amazing experience then. So what was your plan when you were thinking yourself, you know, I mean, obviously I suppose every chef wants to have his own restaurant. What was your plan or your philosophy or thinking behind what you wanted the tannery to be then?
I think a combination of really good food, really good Irish food, because Ireland was just discovering itself in terms of what it was as a food destination right then. We were in the country, so we had to respect that, and portions had to be bigger. That's just the way it is. And people had to be enticed in. It wasn't necessarily their comfort zone spending their evening in a restaurant. The pub would always be, you know, especially for the fellas, you know, they were back of the mind's eye. So we had to be practical. The first and foremost thing, we had to be a restaurant for the locals. And not just for visitors. The locals were the most important thing because they were going to be there in October, November. And, you know, the visitors were the icing on top. So it was a long, it was a big learning curve. I didn't want it to be fancy. I really didn't. We didn't have tablecloths back then, but we do have now, ironically. We're going against the tide of fashion.
At that time, were you out ahead of the curve and come back with all these wonderful experiences from these amazing restaurants in London? You brought that back down to Waterford, and it must have been a great occasion, or I mean, it must have been a great place to go at that time with these. I mean, your food must have been very exciting.
I think it might have been a little bit out there, but the whole, I never wanted it to be out there, actually. It always had to have its feet on the ground. I'm very much rooted in not having fancy food. I mean, I see turnips and soft focus as opposed to baby vegetables, you know. But really, the whole thing is that we have, you know, my wife was front of house. We've got a great team, some of them who are still there. And they would keep my feet on the ground. If something wasn't appealing to people, or just if I was getting notions, let's put it that way, they would slap me around the place and tell me, right, okay, you're cooking for you know, you have to cook for your customers, and that varies from place to place, but they embraced us and we're still here 24 years later.
I think you would probably agree with me, that progression that you had where you really went for excellence, it's really what you would tell any young chef today. I mean, it'd be the same sort of, if you could do that, I suppose. I know everything has changed,
yeah,
but I suppose I don't know what the equivalent of London would be today, but
Ireland,
you know.
You know, this is the beauty about it. I mean, the young kids can they don't have to travel. They're amazing restaurants, and it's not just about restaurants, actually. The whole food scene has opened up wide. Mm. I mean, there's food trucks there. I mean, my ambition is to have a food truck. I swear to God, I want to go from up there, not necessarily to down there, but I just, I love the freedom of it. But we have food in cafes and in restaurants and in food trucks and in stalls that we couldn't have dreamt about years ago. And that's what I love about it. It's egalitarian now, and it's all, people have embraced it. And now people coming to Ireland expect good food, which is not something we could always say. So it's been a food revolution, and it's been brewing over time. And it's for me, who's sort of like the old dog looking back, it's really gratifying to see.
Yeah, I mean, and I was travelling a lot around Ireland recently. I was up north making a little TV programme there, and I was in Kilkenny, I was in Campania, I was down in Kerry. And again, I mean, what you just said, I was blown away by the restaurants and the quality of the food. It really is incredible. Yeah. I mean, the standards now.
Standards, and there's ambition, and there's pride, and there's, you know, there's a big difference between somebody who creates something, and you can tell, as opposed to just somebody who buys something off a supplier and drops it into the deep fryer. I mean, look, there's a time and a place for that as well. I'm not, I try not to be judgy, but good food is something that you have to put your heart and soul into, no matter where you cook it. And it doesn't have to be at the cold face of a London restaurant anymore. It can be something that you, much more organic, and, you know, as long as you're happy doing it, that's the main thing.
Lovely, Paul. Well, listen, that brings us nicely along to your first choice of music this evening, Paul, Kyoto.
Phoebe Bridgers is this amazing lady that lives in Brooklyn, and I will credit Spotify Radio for uncovering her for me. And what it is that, you know, I never wanted to be the guy that listens to the Eagles until he dies, you know, and I love the Eagles, I love 1970s music, all that. The radio setting just churns up music like that artist. And I'm a massive fan of The National. They're my number one band. And they have worked together, Phoebe Bridgers and The National. She sometimes has sung with them. But anyway, in her own right, she is a massive, massively talented artist. And I love, it's from her new album. And it soothes me as I cook at home on a Sunday evening. And I want to bring her to everybody. I'm kind of championing her.
A Taste of Ireland with Ireland's Blue Book, a romantic collection of Irish country house hotels, manor houses, castles and restaurants. Ireland'sBlueBook.com
on Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
Hi, I'm Ed Finn, and welcome back to A Taste of Ireland. My guest this evening is Paul Flynn, chef and owner of The Tannery. Paul, you've written 4 cookery books, am I right?
Yep, Jamie Oliver's quaking in his, in his boots. Yes, I have.
4 An Irish Adventure with Food, 2nd Helpings, which I thought was brilliant. Your 3rd book, Surf and Turf, you wrote with some fella from Cork. Can't remember his name. What was he?
No
something
idea.
Fishy about him.
Mary something. I don't know.
Yeah. Martin Shannon, that great fishy, of course. And you also wrote a very good instructive book, I think, in collaboration with Lidl as well.
Yeah.
Tell me, do you love writing, do you?
I do. I used to be the Irish Times food writer going back 15 years ago. And I was just, I love talking, actually. I never realised I love talking, but I'm pretty good at it, as it turns out. But everybody needs a break. And I think at the time, well, I know at the time, is that we were 2 years into the tannery, or 3 years, something like that. But we used to have really great summers, but the winters were always hard. Seasonality was always a problem. So therefore, getting our name out was a really important thing. Now, you can place ads, but ads cost money. And also, they tend to sit amongst other ads, and everybody knows you paid for them. So when people write about you, or you have another platform, it became apparent very early that I had to for survival. You know, for us to survive, I have to think outside the box. So good fortune can play a part. And the editor of the Irish Times magazine, there wasn't even a magazine at the time. She or her child was in Ring, Patsy Murphy, and she got talking to me, and we just had a big chat and bonded and got on instantly. She said, "Would you write a piece for the Irish Times?" And I said, "On what? I can't write. I can't type. I can't do anything. And you know, I have no qualifications." And I was more bothered than positive about it. Let's put it that way. But she said, "Just have a go." Anyway, so I had a go two or three times. I wrote articles about just, and I really wanted to describe to people what life was like in the country. And how we lived and how we regarded food and what our friends were like. And I was really honest about it because it tended to be a bit all too Dublin. And, you know, there's more to Ireland than Dublin, that's for sure.
Of course. Well, coming from Cork, I can agree with that.
No, you won't even go there. I won't even give you a platform. And but I started writing and I really enjoyed it. And I used to write longhand. Maura used to go in, grab it, take a couple of plates up to the customers and start typing, you know, transcribing what I wrote. Anyway, it went down well. And she asked me to be the food writer for the forthcoming magazine. So I was the food writer for maybe 3.5, nearly 4 years. And that was great. And that gave us that platform. I really did. And what happens that I've learned subsequently is from that, my first book came, there was a book offer, and from that, my first TV series. And so if you're a little shy person in a bush, if you're a business person, you cannot afford to be that. And I'm not necessarily, even though I said I love talking, speaking in front of people isn't my thing. So yeah, really tentatively, I had to learn new skills, I suppose, and bring myself out of myself. And you kind of have to, because you just want to keep the jobs. You want to keep your job. There's a mortgage to be paid. You want to keep everybody else employed. That's the thing. So therefore, you just push yourself out. But from that, various things happen. So, you know, after I became the food writer, and that went by the wayside for maybe 12 years or so, they asked me to be the food writer again. So I have been for the last year. And I type with one finger on my iPhone as fast as I can. And at least I'm self-contained now. I don't have to get Maura to do it for me. Well, I still email it to her and she corrects my punctuation, which apparently is really bad. So I'm delighted. Again, it's still about a new platform and it's another side of me. And I love that. I love the fact that I can sort of, you know, express my feelings and my silly ideas, because I tend to try and be a little bit quirky and really be allowed to be myself, which is an important thing as well.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting, because I remember interviewing George R.R. Martin, the writer of Game of Thrones, a couple of years ago, and he was telling me about his process, you know, and he had a computer and he wasn't connected to the internet, and, you know, he was away from everything, and he used an old TriStar program that was like hundreds of years old, you know. Yeah. But did you have that same thing? You were saying you do it on your phone, so you didn't have your little routines that you had to have, you know, at the end of your book. You lit your cigarette or you had your glass of champagne.
Like. Go for a pint. When you could go for a pint. No, not at all. I'm deliberately not connected to any process, only because I'm useless at technology. That would be the basis of my caveman-esque approach to writing. And I can't use a keyboard, so I just do it. But thankfully, I don't have to write any autobiographies or anything. They're all short.
Writing, I think you'll agree, for people, I suppose, that don't do it, and I do a bit of travel writing as well, it is an amazing sense when you do finish something, and sometimes you look back and you think to yourself, God, did I write that? When I read your stuff, you can actually taste the food. You have a great gift in that respect, and I think, so, I mean, were you delighted with your first book? I mean, that thrill of, you know, holding it in your hands.
Oh, it was amazing. Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, to have it, you have it forevermore. And now, actually, I don't even have a copy of the original one. I gave them all away. But I think there's just a sense of achievement with it, that somebody has had confidence in you to print. You know, they believe you'll sell. And that's a really good thing. Now, it didn't happen massively, I'll have to tell you. But it still is a lovely thing to have. And books do lead on to other things. They really do.
And leading on from there, so, I mean, very interesting how it's a great way, I suppose, keeping the tannery in people's minds and eyes. And then, of course, you went on, I mean, you know, won Lords and Ladles and, you know, all your, I mean, you did so many great TV programmes. And I suppose TV, of course, being a great medium for food and cookery.
It is. And I mean, I have my own comfortable place when it comes to TV. Not that I've done a bit. I haven't done loads, and it's not my first job, because, you know, one day the phone won't ring, and that's a reality. So you have to put it in a place where one day you'll be disappointed and you have to get on with your life and all that. But more than anything else, I really enjoy it. I'm not brilliant at piece the cameras, you know, when you're telling people, you know, how recipes work and all that. There are other people that are amazing, like Rory O'Connell is gifted. I look at him and I go, why can't I be him? But I love being out and about with other people. I particularly love interacting with other chefs, Lords and Ladles. You know, Derry and Catherine are brilliant, and the team that are, and just being kind of thrust into this environment where you have to cook, understand it, make it edible, which is always important, particularly with Lords and Ladles, because some stuff, the recipes were challenging to say the least. But it's an experience. It really is a lovely, I used to always just love getting into the car. So you'd have 3 days blocked off, work would be all boxed off, let's put it that way, because you wouldn't be leaving otherwise. And thanks to my head chef and Maura and Daniel and everybody else who runs the place when I'm not there, and you just go off and it's an adventure, and I love it.
You have to blank out everything else and just focus, laser focus, really.
Yeah, and it can be really a bit weird, and sorry, this is a bit name droppy and apologise, but I never think of myself as anything more than somebody who was in a kitchen, a chef just working to make nice food for people all the time. But we were in New York, and friends of mine, we were watching Codaline.
Oh yeah.
And then there's these two, and they were young. Normally I get older ladies shuffling up to me. But these are a young couple. They were just saying, are you? Anyway, they couldn't believe that I was standing there. But they were fans of Lords and Ladles. And for a long time, I was on Netflix. And I was in USA, it was in Canada, it was in Australia, New Zealand, all that kind of stuff. So I was more embarrassed than they were, to be honest with you. But I couldn't believe it was happening. I'm getting recognised at a Codaline concert.
I thought you were going to say it was from Moran Dahi or something like
that. No, don't mind that fella.
I saw you trying to teach Dahi a few things and tricks over the years, but I wondered how did it work.
No, it's pointless. Now, he has got an understanding of food. Sometimes he amazes me. I mean, it's slowly sinking in. He's by no means stupid, as you well know. Mm. But look, we work together because we do a lot of ploughing together. Dahi would be there all day, every
up
day.
In the back of the tractor. Worker.
He'd be up in the back of anything. You wouldn't know. But
I love it.
We had the crack.
Brilliant. Come here. You decided then, of course, another progression, which was really interesting. You then opened your rooms. You became a place to stay. Townhouse.
What happened was that, I mean, all due to our effort, myself and Maura, is just we wanted to be a really good restaurant. And again, I said at the start, not just for the locals, but, you know, we wanted people to travel to us. And they started doing that, and they were looking for a place to stay. So the natural progression from that was to put on rooms, and we've 14 rooms now and a cookery school.
And the cookery school is fantastic. Again, I know a few people that have gone to it, and they were telling me even basic stuff like cutting onions and things like that that a lot of people struggle with, like me included. They came away very pleased with themselves.
Good. Well, that's good. I mean, the thing is that I learned pretty quickly that it's now not about showing people that you can cook. It's about showing them how to cook. So you start off simply. And there is different, as with any class and any teacher, is that I don't assume that people know loads. And just to find that middle ground that everybody's happy with. So hopefully I enjoy teaching, and I enjoy, but I don't do it in a very serious way. You know, I tend to go off piste an awful lot, and I look at people's faces and I go, oh my God, have I gone too far? In terms of showing people that cooking is very much, you know, about adding a little bit of this and a little bit of that until you get something that tastes nice. And it's not something to be scared of. Black is usually, unless it's a truffle, is the colour to be avoided, and smoke and bad smells. But aside from that, it can be, if you take your time and, you know, love the process. And there are lots of people out there who love cooking for the sake of it, me included. And that doesn't include cooking for your children when they're about to arrive home from school, starving with the hunger. That's a different thing altogether.
And Paul, what's really is you're a member, of course, of Ireland's Blue Book. Yeah. What does it mean for the tannery to be part of the Blue Book?
Well, a lot. It means a lot. And it's sort of, when they asked us, we weren't sure that we would be ready for it, because I mean the whole thing about Blue Book going back is that they've big beautiful houses, big beautiful rooms, and you know, stately homes in many cases, and long admired and long cherished businesses that have been there for generations in many cases. And then, you know, we're a townhouse, so by its nature, you know, the rooms aren't as big, but we have a great reputation for food that we uphold and try to uphold all the time. So we're really privileged to be part of it. And, you know, Ross, there are other restaurants there, Ross Lewis and Derry at Liquor Van and Chapter One are there as well, and lots more in Giebel's.
Yeah, and Campania down in Kilkenny. Great spot, Gareth Byrne.
And we're honoured to be part of it, really are.
It seems to be a terrific network of support as well for everybody. That's what I get when I talk to different people who are the members there.
It really is.
That brings us nicely on, Paul, to your second choice of music this evening. This is a very popular piece of music with chefs, right? You're the second chef that's asked for this. And very interesting. It must be very relaxing in the kitchen.
Well, I'm actually a bit disappointed with myself because, so this is Steve, it's from an album called Steve McQueen from Prefab Sprout. The album is 30 years old. And I deliberately didn't choose the most obvious tune from it, which is Cars and Girls. I chose Bonnie, which is, for me, the better song. But lo and behold, you told me that Ross Lewis chose Bonnie. Of all the songs in all the world that we had to choose the same song, I texted him and said, that's Mad Ted. And yes, so it's obviously striking a chord.
A Taste of Ireland with Ireland's Blue Book. A romantic collection of Irish country house hotels, manor houses, castles and restaurants. Ireland'sBlueBook.com
on Dublin's easy place to relax.
Sunshine 106.8. Sunshine 106.8.
Hi, I'm Ed Finn and welcome back to A Taste of Ireland. My guest this evening is Paul Flynn, chef and owner of the tannery, scribe, TV personality. Paul, listen, you've done it all.
Well, the modelling still eludes me, Ed, actually. I'm hoping for that this year.
Yeah, well, you're looking good now, I must say.
Yeah, underpants for the larger man.
We were chatting there earlier, you were telling me that you're an avid traveller, festival goer and a camper van enthusiast. But just, if we just take the first one at the start, travelling, of course, would be something. I was on a school tour when I was 14, and amazing trip we went off to Italy, Switzerland, the south of France, and we got the ferry back, which was an amazing experience. Where did you get your love of travel from?
I think my love of travel is because I have my own business and I can do it as much as I'd like to. That's where the love comes from. So when I do it, I really make the most of it and I really cherish it and I don't forget it. So I am, just before we set up the tannery, myself and Maura, we were going to do a round the world trip after La Stampa. And you know what? We nearly had the tickets bought. And it's one of the biggest things that I regret in life, that I didn't do it. Because once you make the commitment to have your own business, you kind of, you're stuck to it. And you can't, all you can do then is become, I don't know, a holiday traveller. And I'm not knocking that at all. I am one myself. But you can't actually immerse yourself in a culture and travel with no worries of work. And, you know, the freedom of where will we go next. I never did that. And it's always been a regret of mine. But the travelling just, I would lie under the covers reading Condé Nast Traveller. So obviously I'm top end.
high end.
Yeah, high end, yeah. I'd love to go there, I'd love to go there, and they'd be on the list. And we always used to love taking city breaks whenever we could. And we've two teenagers now, we bring them whenever we can as well. And I love to have a plan from, okay, we're doing this in October during Halloween, then we'll do this. And can I get away possibly? And one thing I did about 3 years ago, I was at the ploughing with Dahi. And, you know, there was a break and I went around the corner and this company called Camino Ways had, they had a stand. And I'd always wanted to do the Camino. And I did that very shortly after with my best friend. And I was just liberating. And what was liberating about it is like traveling slowly from the inside. And I just thought, I'm not religious, but I do appreciate history and churches and countryside and food and everything. And it was an epiphany for me. In that, I've a very busy mind. In that, between running, we don't have an empire, but it keeps us busy. And it was just a switch off. It was a switch off like I never had it before. And so I've done it. I was due to go this May, and it was transferred to October, a food tour. And I was kind of thinking, people actually pay to go on holidays with me? They're mad. But we were going to do vineyards and tapas and tasting menus and all of that. But the only thing I can't do is speak Spanish. I wish I could, but I can't.
Well, I did Saria to Santiago, and I mean, religion, I mean, it's interesting how it's completely really a spiritual kind of a quest. But another trip I did, we actually drove the whole Camino. And I mean, it was amazing. We went into Pamplona and Navarra, you know, where, you know, Hemingway used to drink, and Rioja, of course, the smallest province. And we did Leon, and we went up into Asturias and Cantabria, the famous cider there. And it's just mind blowing. So, I mean, if I know it's cheating to drive it, but it was a wet, June, and we wanted to see everything.
Yeah, you're giving me ideas here now.
Yeah.
But you did see everything. And that, and
amazing.
That, and the history attached to these places. I so caught up and I take it in. I think it's an education in a completely different way.
Hopefully you'll be back doing that again soon.
I will. But I did go, the second time I went with my vegetarian marathon running older brother. And to say he left me for dust now was the understatement of the year. I was puffing and panting behind him. We walked from actually Bilbao to Santander.
Beautiful.
And it was different. We didn't end up in Santiago this time. Yeah. But Santander is amazing. And I could talk about it all day long and bore the pants off people. But what's really important as well is the food. I have to have good food if I travel in a country. And the Spanish just have it in a very simple way that's inherent in them. It's a lovely thing.
We can't really chat without talking about this very, very difficult time for anybody in the hospitality restaurant business. It's thrown everything upside down for so many people. Yeah. How are you coping? How is it going?
Well, I'm lucky. We're lucky that the tannery is in a very beautiful seaside town that's really come into its own in the last 3 or 4 years because we've a greenway there. So we're very lucky. And I'm acutely aware that, I mean, say for instance, my comrades in Dublin, had an awful time, and the people in the Midlands, and we were lucky to be where we were, but we're used to seasonality. We're used to busy summers, so we have the reverse of what everybody else has anyway. And you know, October, November, even December can be dismal for us. But I just hope that, you know, to come up to Dublin, I was up here 2 weeks ago and we stayed, and to come up and see the streets deserted, and I know the people are really worried. And really kind of, when you have your own business, and this just doesn't just apply to restaurateurs. We were talking about travel agents. We were talking about, of course, the publicans. There are many other people that have to rely on themselves for their own living, their mortgages to pay. It's not just about the restaurateurs. You hear about them more than anything else, but there's lots of people suffering and in many different ways. And I pine for the way things were. We have to accept reality now and just hope that in some way, shape or form, it returns as soon as it can. But there are people in trouble, so I think supporting them is a really important thing. And there's a lot of people out there who are too nervous to go outside the door. But I just urge you, I suppose, to, for your own sake as well, you know, just to get out and feel part of society again is a really important thing, and to support those people who need it.
Dungarvan, of course, I mean, it is just one of the most beautiful settings. I mean, the bay there, and I mean, yeah, the Greenway has just transformed the place in a way, hasn't it?
It's come into its own. We're very lucky. We're lucky that it happened to us because, you know, we're not in the Wild Atlantic Way, but we have this. Finally, we have this. And you know, you see lots. The thing about business and about locations that formerly that aren't well known, if you build it, they will come. I mean, the way that our town has transformed in terms of cafes and restaurants and facilities and accommodation and Airbnbs and all that is just amazing. And it's a tribute to people's, I suppose, innovative tendencies. You know, they're entrepreneurial spirit is the way I want to put it, that if they see people, the best of them comes out. And that's a wonderful thing to see. We've been there 24 years now, and to see we built our restaurant in a derelict leather factory, which doesn't really go by the rules, you know. But yeah, footfall was a very important thing when you set up a business. We had none. But through perseverance and dedication and passion, we have customers that come to us all the time, and we hope to and strive for that, you know, for a good few years to come.
I see there as well, I was having a look on your website, a lot of stuff, I mean, coming in for September, October, is there going to be an awful lot of value out there for people? Yeah. So I think your message really is very good. Get out there and support. Yeah. We'll all have to support our staycation yourself to within an inch of your life.
Even in the colder months, even in the months that you wouldn't think of moving. I mean, we've had a lot of months where we couldn't move at all, and months where you couldn't get into places.
Yeah.
And now, like the winter months, the hard shoulder months is what they call them, you know, get out, and there's plenty of people that are just ready and able and willing to make you feel at home.
I'm going to ask a few questions now that all chefs hate, right? So you'll be what is your pet hate about service?
Oh, but well, things are getting more difficult. Yeah. I mean, they are, but we just have to roll with it. You know, things are getting more difficult in the sense that, you know, gluten-free is something that we have to really be aware of and be careful of. Vegetarianism, we just have to embrace, and I'm okay with that. I totally am okay with it. Veganism is another thing, you know, okay. But, you know, we have to, like, the whole allergies thing has become way more prevalent
Ireland. So the sort of, don't even get me started on calories on menus.
Yeah.
But, you know, running a business is challenging, and it's becoming more challenging every day. And, but look, we just have to stay open. These are what we have to do. We have to embrace them and go with it. And this is just the latest.
I know when we were growing up, the allergies didn't seem to exist at all. It's funny, isn't it? Whatever, no. Chemical, whatever, it's over the years, it seems to have exploded.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, I guess it's a bit of a difficult one if you're trying to control all these different, getting all this food out of people.
There's responsibility in it. You know, and if somebody, in the middle of a really busy Saturday night, where you're, it's like cooking in a busy restaurant is like going to war every night, right? In a contained, hopefully, eventually delightful way, if that makes any sense. But, you know, if somebody comes down, then we're told that, okay, somebody's really allergic to garlic. Now, is it that you don't like it or you will die instantly on the spot?
You're a vampire.
There's a massive difference. So you have to ascertain this under pressure.
Yeah.
But a lot of people are really good and they phone ahead. If it's really serious, people phone ahead. But look, this is just part and parcel of what we do and we just get on with it.
In terms of something that you love as your guilty pleasure, like it can be a tuna sandwich or whatever, what do you love to have?
There are consequences to what I used to love battered sausages. I still do. You know, there's a few really good chippers in town, and Chips is our best friend Eunice Power. She's very well known herself, but stopping by the chipper late at night is kind of, I had to stop it a few years ago because the stretchy pants were even under a massive pressure.
But finally, Paul, I have to ask you this question now, and this is very important. What is the secret of making a good blah?
Oh, geez, it's a good blah. I can't believe, just because I'm from Waterford, I swear to God.
I know, I have to ask everyone. Ross was asked about tripe and drisheen.
Was he? Oh, drisheen's a day.
So I don't know what else is from Waterford.
I've had drisheen, I nearly fainted.
So people might know, you can tell people in case they don't know what a blah is.
Well, a blah is a flowery bap. Don't call it a flowery bap. I hear loads of people saying in Waterford already now. It was brought over to Waterford by the Huguenots, and it's associated with Waterford in a very major way. It also has a protected status. You know, like it does, yeah.
Wow.
I know.
Lords and ladles.
Yeah, and it's also got, for men, massive fertility benefits.
So, wow, the blah.
The blah. So you didn't know it. Like, yeah, you'd be like an engine. You'd be like a nuclear power station.
What goes into it? Is it like...
I especially can't tell a corkman.
So, okay, well, if you can't... What's the best thing to eat with it, then?
Bacon.
Okay.
Bacon. All right. Absolutely. It is. And you get the flour of it. Yeah. You can't eat a blah on the quiet, you know, because there's flour on top and you get it all over your nose. And so, you know, you get found out eventually.
So after you've had the lovely experience in the tannery, the next day you can, after you've worked, when you're out and about for lunch, maybe you can have the blah.
All over the place.
That brings us along to our last piece of music this evening. And can you tell us about Think About Things?
Right. This is, I also wanted to show that I'm kind of hip with the kids, you know, but music is a massive part of my life. When I was 40, I started going to festivals because I thought I was too old until then. And then I went to Electric Picnic and I've been going to Electric Picnic ever since. And any other festival that I could manage to get away with whilst, you know, work-wise. But it's the joy of music, really. We used to just work hard and play hard in London and in Dublin. Anyway, so you work all day. 12-hour days, 13-hour, it doesn't matter. But then on Oxford Street, we go to clubs for a couple of hours. Not every night, but maybe 3 nights a week we would. And then you'd be up again at 6:30, 7. We used to just be able to do it. And the joy of music for me is massive in my life. And this, without banging on too long, this is the Icelandic entry into the Eurovision for 2020. It should have won it, hands down, it should have won it. You should just check out the video as well. It is a thing of genius. But when we heard it first, we heard it in my local pub, Downey's, and we nearly all, okay, it might have been late into the night, we all got up and started dancing. We didn't hear the music before, and it just is absolutely pumping joy into your body.
Brilliant. Well, Paul Flynn, it has been a great pleasure to chat to you this evening. And here we go with Think About Things, Daddy Freyr.
Baby, I can't.